You are listening to a podcast from The National.
Welcome to Extra Time, The National's Premier League podcast. I'm your host, John Turner. Joining me today on the show, sports reporter John McCauley, Deputy Sports Editor Steve Luckings. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Very good, mate. How are you?
Good. Very good.
Good,
good stuff. So, chaps, goals, shocks, controversy, Lukaku scoring against West Ham, Liverpool conceding from corners. Can only mean one thing, can't it? Obviously, the Premier League season's now back. So let's kind of start with the champions. It's been a pretty shambolic start to their title defence. Things weren't exactly going swimmingly heading into the season, but no one could have expected what happened at Stamford Bridge on Saturday. Just give us your thoughts on what happened at Stamford Bridge.
Well, honestly, I think it was sorry to use the cliche, but almost a match of two halves, really, because although Chelsea were shambolic, I mean, no team should go 3-0 down at home, especially to Burnley. But I thought the fight back in the second half and the difference that Alvaro Morata made when he came on, especially when they were down to nine men, you really fancied if that game had gone an extra 5 minutes that Chelsea would have equalised. So, there's plenty to ponder for Antonio Conte, no doubt. First of all, is a lack of team discipline. I mean, what is that, three games on the trot? They've had a man or men sent off. But, I mean, the quality they showed to get back in the game or to make a real fist of getting back in the game, I think there's plenty of encouragement there as well.
You talk about the ill discipline, John. First game of the season, surely you want to be cutting out sarcastic clapping at referees, studs up challenges. I mean, clearly referees are going to crack down more on that in the opening weeks when it's the opening days of the season. As Steve said, that the ill discipline is inexcusable.
Yeah, especially when you think there's not, a lot of stuff riding on this. I know you want to get off to a good start, but it's not as if this is the tail end of the season whenever tempers are going to get a bit flared or whatever. I thought, Fabregas, people say other people are not that sort of player. He is that sort of
absolutely.
Player.
That's the thing. He's as petulant as they come.
Yeah. So, that was, once he had gotten the booking, first of all, for silly booking, as you said, for clapping the referee, you just knew something else was going to happen. You knew he was going to get himself sent off. So I think it's just indicative of what seems to be going on at Chelsea at the minute in terms of there's a lot of stuff going on with Conte and not getting the players he wanted, and he does seem unhappy. I thought he looked quite sullen on the touchline, which isn't like him. I don't know if he's trying to make a statement. He was even wearing the tracksuit instead of the suit, so I thought that was all part of the, I'm not enjoying myself at the moment. So I think it all played into that, but you've got Cahill getting himself sent off for... Some people were saying that he shouldn't have been sent off because he didn't connect with the ball or the man, but if he had it done...
Yeah, that would have been catastrophic.
Yeah, doing serious damage. So, as I said, it just kind of all plays into this. Things aren't quite right at Chelsea at the minute, but there's a couple of weeks left in the transfer market. I'm sure they'll try and sort it out.
The one bright spot, as you mentioned there, Steve, Alvaro Morata coming off the bench, 31 minutes on the pitch, a goal and assist. Chelsea fans can get pretty excited about what this guy can offer this season. I mean, it's very early days, but signs are encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we looked at the Opta heat map, didn't we? Mishi Batshuayi didn't touch the ball in Burnley's penalty area. Morata comes on, and as you say, a goal and an assist. Looked a threat for the entire 31 minutes he was on. And, I think he's automatically a starter for the Spurs game at the weekend. He proved in that brief cameo exactly why Chelsea spent so much money on him.
Sorry, John.
No, I was just going to say, he has to be a starter. I don't think there's any players left. Yes.
That's what I was going to say. Now with Fabregas suspended, Matic sold, they haven't got any centre midfielders,
have they? And Bakayoko not fit.
No, it's not the best of starts for the champions, and they need to rectify it very quickly. It seems strange making these kind of statements after one game of the season, but there just seems to be so much unrest there at the moment that they need to sort out, and they need to sort out quickly. But as we mentioned last week, they play Spurs at Wembley, which is usually only one thing.
But I tell you one thing that stood out for me was how subdued N'Golo Kante looked as well. Now, I certainly can't put the defeat at his doorstep, but, he clearly needs someone alongside him to flourish. Now, that was Matic last season, Danny Drinkwater, of all people, the season before. But, Fabregas should have been a leading man in that team, and he wasn't. He was, you know, he let his teammates down. But Kante, you know, he was well off the pace yesterday.
It was a dismal start for the champions. Their opponents next weekend, as we've just touched on, Tottenham at Wembley, their new home for the season. They got off to a much brighter start. There was kind of a few kind of concerns or a few grumblings about their lack of transfer activity this summer. None more so from their own left back, Danny Rose. but pretty efficient stuff at Newcastle. It was kind of Old Faithful delivering as usual. Christian Eriksen pulling strings. Dele Alli scoring a goal.
Yeah, it was a strange kind of game. It was a very lacklustre first half. I mean, yeah, the one noticeable thing about it was the reception that Moussa Sissoko got from both sets of fans, really. He was maligned by Newcastle and his own Tottenham fans. But, yeah, like you say, once Eriksen kind of clicked into gear, I mean, they must have strung about 20, 25 passes together for the first goal. And wonderfully floated ball over to Dele Alli. Of course, helped by another stupid sending off. Probably not as stupid as Fabregas's, but Jonjo Shelvey's stamp on Dele Alli, when it's not as if the referee was more than 2 yards away looking directly. They were both looking directly at each other. So to do that in front of the referee was as idiotic as it comes. But, you know, Newcastle were giving a decent enough account of themselves in that time. And then after sending off, you could only see one winner.
Mm-hmm. I thought that as well. I thought if you look at it from the Spurs' point of view, as you said, it's the reliables. It's, you know, it's that front three really that they play, because they didn't play with three just behind Kane. But I still fear, like I know we'll touch on this later in the show with Manchester United. But you look at United, were full of verve and pace and everything, especially Rashford. Spurs don't have that, and that's something that would concern me going forward, because I would think that they need something a little bit different than just having. I know it's just Eriksen and just Dele Alli, but if Eriksen's not on song or he's not there, I think Spurs need something else to change that up, and Sissoko's certainly not the one to do that.
It was better performance than the last time they played Newcastle, though.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that.
What happened then?
Newcastle scored a few goals. I forget how many.
Dead rubber anyway, wasn't it? So Chelsea have got plenty to be worried about, do you think? Or do you think going to Wembley next weekend, it's a chance to start anew, and they've still got a good chance of getting something at Tottenham. What's your kind of feelings in the initial aftermath of the opening weekend?
Well, I think, you know, Colts touched on this a lot last week. A lot is going to depend on how well Spurs adapt to their new surroundings, their new home throughout the season. No one in Europe could match their record unbeaten at home last season. Are they going to replicate that at Wembley? It's going to be very, very tough. But certainly, based on the opening game's evidence, Spurs go into that with a lot of confidence. You know, I think over three games we played Chelsea last season, I think you take the FA Cup semi-final out of that, where Chelsea were much the better team. I think Spurs, over 180 minutes of Premier League football, were the better side. So I think they go into that, obviously, sparked with confidence of an away win. Chelsea, like you say, depleted. Clearly all is not well in Antonio Conte's kitchen. You know, Diego Costa's come out today slamming the club and Conte in particular for treating him like a criminal, for trying to make him train with the reserves. You know, there's so many underlying disquiet grumblings in the club that you just sense that this is Tottenham's time to really put a dent into Chelsea.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, what you know, glorious failure in Spurs and all of that. You know, once the odds are stacked in their favour, they don't usually come through. So if Spurs get through that, that's a massive mental barrier I think they've overcome, because, as I said, they will, strangely enough, because they're against the champions, I think they'll go into that as favourites, the way the two teams are set up. But, you know, they need to prove, A, to get over the Wembley hoodoo, and then a bit of a Chelsea one as well.
Just on a side note, what a debut from Kyle Walker-Peters? Sorry, I can't even say people's names right. Kyle Walker-Peters. He was solid, not spectacular. But Spurs aren't missing one Kyle Walker after that performance, are they?
No, certainly not.
Do you think that's why they haven't gone out and recruited, thinking Trippier's number one, this guy's an able deputy?
Yeah, definitely. Again, we touched on it last week. I think Trippier, after watching the City game against Brighton, you know, Kyle Walker's a fantastic player, but he cuts the ball back so many times. I think I saw him deliver two crosses, and granted, they were actually two very good crosses. But Trippier will give you a ball and a dangerous ball in, a dangerous pass in. in that corridor of uncertainty. I'm sorry, I'm using all the terrible cliches I can think of today. But, you know, Trippier does offer you that. He offers you quick ball in, quality balls in as well, which is something that Kyle Walker doesn't.
It was a good win for City this weekend, though, wasn't it? Let's talk about the favourites, the pre-season title favourites. They met some resistance against the newly promoted Brighton, but in the end, a pretty professional job in the end by City, by Guardiola's men.
Yeah, I don't think they really had to get out of second gear. Like you say, Brighton chased a lot of the ball. It was inevitable that City were going to wear them down at some point. And you know, if you've got a guy like Sergio Aguero in your team, he rarely needs even half a chance now. But he always looked the most likely to open the scoring. The second goal, an own goal, you know, we've touched on the kind of great attacking verve that we've seen throughout this game. I think some of the defending we've seen from the opening weekend has been absolutely terrible. The Brighton goalkeeper, the header was straight at him. There was no need for him to throw it on his way into the net. But yeah, like you say, City, they had plenty of the ball. They were always going to unlock Brighton, you felt. And yeah, it took 70 minutes, but after that, the result wasn't in doubt.
Yeah, I thought City dealt very well with the occasion, if you know what I mean, because they were obviously, you know, the stadium was packed. Everyone was looking forward to Brighton's big debut in the Premier League. So I thought City they were pretty comfortable, pretty professional about it. And the fact that you looked at their bench, even if they weren't, you know, they hadn't scored by that stage or hadn't broken the deadlock, you looked at the bench, they had Sané on the bench, Sterling, Silva, Bernardo Silva, Yaya Toure, who started playing like Yaya Toure really should towards the end of last season. So, you know, it's a frightening prospect, I think, for the rest of the league. And if you're starting with Aguero and Jesus up front, it's not bad starting point to go from.
City started last season pretty well, and everyone thought they were going to win the league by record points, record goals, go and do the treble, and it didn't quite turn out that way. But they're looking more solid this year, aren't they? I mean, hindsight's a beautiful thing and all, but I mean, is there again a danger that things could unravel at some point, or do you think they're just better stocked this season to kind of deal with any adversity?
I think they're better stocked, and I think the key to this, and it, again, is something we've touched on before, keeping Vincent Kompany fit, increases your chances of success tenfold. You know, he ended the season very well. He's obviously starting this season as a first choice. They have recruited superbly, £100 million, probably £200 million worth of talent that was on the bench that didn't get a go. And it's interesting as well to see him starting with Jesus and Aguero up front. There's been plenty of talk of who would be the one of them to drop out, you know, whether it was just for this game or not. But, I mean, the two of them up front just look so exciting. Even for the neutral, you just want to see them two guys catch fire and go on a run.
And I think as well, Kevin De Bruyne, you know, you do have Bernardo Silva, as we touched on last week, and you've got David Silva, who again was just a very calming presence in midfield. But I think with De Bruyne, they've got one of the best players in the league, and he's going to be one of the players of the season. I think he's going to be the sort of guy that's going to carry them to the title.
You mentioned all those players on the bench there, Cooks, but there surely is still a danger of squad harmony not being able to keep everyone happy. You're going to have guys like, I mean, if Kompany stays fit, Otamendi occupying the bench most of the season. Raheem Sterling, you can't see how he gets into their strongest 11 anymore, despite the fact Guardiola's clearly a big fan. How do you see that being a problem this year?
Yeah, we waxed lyrical about Bernardo Silva last week, but we all agreed that we didn't think that Guardiola would start with him, that maybe it would be a gradual introduction for him into the Premier League. But look, City are going to be fighting on four fronts this season. They're going to need a big squad. And, you know, you're not hearing too many, noises about players wanting to leave or even transfer bids coming in for too many of their players. So, you know, the harmony seems to be there for now. It, you know, is terrifying to think how well someone like Leroy Sané played last season but didn't start this season. But, you know, there's going to be plenty of opportunities for these guys.
Yeah, the only problem in that, I would say, maybe Yaya Toure. You know, can you keep him happy? He's someone who...
Can anyone keep Yaya Toure happy?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, does he have any kind of given right to be starting in that team? I don't think so. But another little thing, I do think, strangely, City could do with another kind of enforcer in midfield. Fernandinho, for me, is decent enough, but I don't think he's that top level whenever you're coming into the crux of the Premier League and Champions League football as well.
It's about keeping Gundogan fit as well, I think, isn't it, in that centre midfield? Because, I mean, he's almost a forgotten man, but he's a top, top level centre midfielder.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it slipped my mind. It seems hard to think that he was such a major signing last summer's transfer window and has only played a handful of games. Yeah, you're absolutely right. He is the type of player that Coach just mentioned that is really what City could be looking for.
We'll get back to football in just a second, but first we'd like to tell you about the other podcast from The National. Beyond the Headlines takes a deeper dive into the biggest news from the week with a distinct Middle Eastern point of view. And Business Extra is the best source to learn more about the figures who make the region such an important hub in the world. Subscribe to both shows as well as Extra Time on iTunes. And as always, we're online at thenational.ae. We didn't forget about Manchester United and Liverpool. We just wanted to bring in an expert opinion. On the line from Bolton, Premier League correspondent Richard Jolly. Rich, how are you doing today, mate?
Good, thank you.
Very well, thank you, very well. Richard, we'd love to really start with Manchester United. You were obviously at the game at Old Trafford, where they trounced West Ham United. Very encouraging start from United. Mourinho will obviously be quite pleased with what he saw. Are they starting to look like a Manchester United of old? The pace, the power, the goals that seem to be coming back?
I think they are. I think the key word you used there is pace, because a lot of times in recent seasons, Manchester United have been pretty ponderous. Now, that was Louis van Gaal's style of play anyway. But even last season, when Zlatan Ibrahimovic scored a very good number of goals himself, 28 in all competitions, he didn't give them that pace in the forward line. Romelu Lukaku's first goal yesterday, I thought, was a real indication of the difference he makes running in behind. Marcus Rashford's obviously electric. He was outstanding yesterday, and his selection was a real sign of Mourinho's analytical brain, really. He looked at West Ham, he saw Pablo Zabaleta at right-back, who has been a fantastic player, maybe even the best right-back in Premier League history, but he isn't very quick anymore. Mourinho put Marcus Rashford up against him, and it was a bit old-school United, even just in the fact they scored four goals. They haven't done that very often, certainly not in the Premier League, for really since Sir Alex Ferguson left. Many Mourinho wins, I think. I always think the archetypal Mourinho win is 2-0, having one goal and then the insurance policy of a second. But it was interesting to see United went out and, having got that 2-0 win, then showed the attacking intent to go and score two more. And I think that will have given the fans a lot of optimism. And just the sight of, you know, Anthony Martial and Paul Pogba at the end, late goals, even when they don't change the result, late goals still change the feel of proceedings. 2-0 would have felt fairly regulation. 4-0 sent them to the top of the league. 4-0 becomes a rout. And it became reflective of their actual dominance during the game, because West Ham could not complain about that scoreline.
Of course, it was Manchester United are going to find a lot tougher challenges throughout the season. But do you feel that we're going to see more of this style of play from Manchester United, this more sort of relentlessness, attacking football that isn't normally associated with Mourinho throughout his career?
I think we are going to see more of it. I mean, I don't think it'd be gung-ho, kamikaze stuff, but I also think that Mourinho is a very analytical man, and he will have recognised where United came up short last season, and that was basically at Old Trafford, where they drew 10 games, a lot of them against teams like West Ham, who finished in the bottom half of the league. And so this isn't so much a case of Mourinho attacking for attacking sake, Kevin Keegan style. This is a case of a pragmatic recognition of, how do you get better? Well, you get better by winning more of those home games. That's the simplest way for Manchester United to get into the top four. And the simplest way to win those home games is basically just to attack more. I mean, he does have more attacking players now, really. I mean, in the sense that Henrik Mkhitaryan's in his second season at United, Rashford's kicking on, Lukaku is a replacement for Ibrahimovic, but he gives that extra dimension in terms of his pace. Paul Pogba, I think, will score more goals this season, partly because just he was a bit unlucky last season. He kept hitting the woodwork. Even if half of his efforts that hit the woodwork last season had gone in, he'd have probably had about another four goals. I think you'll see Pogba in maybe double figures, possibly even 15 goals in all competitions. And in terms of the tactical setup as well, I think that was more attacking. I think for the tough games and for the away games, Mourinho will bring Ander Herrera into that team, so he'll have three central midfielders with Pogba, Herrera and Matic. But for the home games, and particularly the winnable home games that United didn't win last season, which means West Ham, Burnley, Bournemouth, Stoke, games like that. It will be the 4-2-3-1 with Pogba, with Lukaku, and with three attacking midfielders in between them to give them quite a lot of goal threats.
Richard, the Old Trafford has always been traditionally known as one of the sort of great fortresses in world football. Certainly the last few seasons, with the kind of drop-off in results, there's been a real flat atmosphere around the place, feelings of frustration. What was the atmosphere like yesterday? Of course, it was a lot more upbeat.
It was more upbeat. It's still a quiet ground, and for large amounts of the time, it was the West Ham fans you could hear singing. But I think it's not so much the atmosphere within the crowd that matters as the atmosphere in the opposition dressing room. Because when I used to cover games towards the end of Sir Alex Ferguson's reign, you just feel that a lot of opponents were beaten before they started, and they would have settled for a 2-0 defeat, providing they didn't get hammered. And in recent years, that has changed, and the fear factor has gone. It started to go during David Moyes' reign, and you just get all these teams that were used to just losing at Old Trafford would turn up and they'd win there for the first time in 20, 30, 40 years, in some cases the first time ever. And you go through a whole list of clubs, whether it's Swansea, whether it's Newcastle, whether it's West Brom, whether it's Southampton, and they would all be winning at Old Trafford. And once they'd done that once, and then when they were coming up against the United team that looked unexceptional, really, they would always go with more confidence. And in many cases, these were the sorts of clubs who got draws at Old Trafford last season. So what United really need, and what a 4-0 win against West Ham should help produce, is just the approach from opponents that they don't think they can get anything at Old Trafford. And the more, and that becomes, that kind of triggers itself. When one team loses at Old Trafford and then another one loses and another one, the next one turns up and they think, we're going to lose as well. And that's what you see with teams with good home records. They don't have to be outstanding every game. If they win enough games and they win some in really impressive fashion, opponents just don't expect to get anything there. That happened at Stamford Bridge when Mourinho was in charge. It happened at White Hart Lane last season. It happened at Old Trafford for years, and it could happen at Old Trafford again.
Interesting stuff. Richard, do you see Mourinho strengthening again before the end of the summer transfer window, or do you think he's pretty content with his lot at the moment? There was obviously, they kind of threw the hat in a potential ring for Gareth Bale that was always, it was more just kind of announcing their interest more than anything else. Can you see him delving into the market one more time?
He definitely wants to. Mourinho's model for a summer very much tends to be four major transfer targets. It was last summer, it was this summer. He's got three of them, even though Lindelof didn't play on Sunday. The fourth one he wants is for someone to add a bit extra on the flanks. Now, obviously, Gareth Bale would be ideal, but Mourinho's a realist. He recognised that was only going to happen if Real Madrid wanted to get rid of Bale. The one that they wanted for most of the summer, which they seem to have ended their interest in, is Inter Milan's Croatian winger Ivan Perisic. There's also been some talk about Danny Rose, who obviously wouldn't come in as a winger, but would come in as a fullback who would add a bit more. I think in Mourinho's ideal world, he would want one more winger and one more fullback. He knows he can't get them both this summer, but I do think he would like to get one more player on the flanks. But if it's not Perisic, and if it's not Bale, and if it's not Danny Rose, I'm not sure who it would be.
Interesting. Right, Richard, I'd like to kind of pick your brains about the one remaining game we haven't discussed so far this week, and that's Liverpool's 3-3 draw at Watford. It seems like the same old story for Klopp's team. Electric going forward, plenty of goals, but still suspect at the back.
Absolutely, yeah, and suspect at the back in a particularly familiar fashion as well. I mean, ever since he came in, set pieces have been a problem for Liverpool. I remember a draw about a month into his reign when Tony Pulis's West Brom scored a couple of goals at Anfield from set pieces. And then here we are 18 months later and it's Watford scoring goals from set pieces and Miguel Britos joining the long list of opposing defenders who've gone up for a corner or a free kick against Liverpool and scored a goal that has cost them. And I think maybe Liverpool might have got even better going forward. I think Mohamed Salah could be a superb signing. I think it was significant he scored on his debut. He's been really good in pre-season. And with him and Sadio Mane, that's double trouble for opposing defenders. But arguably the most important deal of anyone that Liverpool could have done this summer would have been to get a dominant, commanding centre-back. They still haven't got Virgil van Dijk. It remains to be seen if that one will be resolved. But without him, they've got the same structural issues and the same personnel issues. I don't think Van Dijk would be able to solve both of those, because no one would. But when you've got both structural and personnel issues, you're going to concede at set pieces, particularly in a league where there are quite a lot of teams who devote time and attention to it, who have good delivery and who have good men in the box.
Looking ahead to their next assignment, Richard, they've got Hoffenheim away in a UEFA Champions League qualifier tonight. The big name that's missing from the travelling party, of course, is Philippe Coutinho. Now, a back injury is the official reason for his absence at the weekend and for tonight. But, of course, the Barcelona noise isn't going away either. How do you see this playing out? How do you kind of see this ending?
I see it ending with Coutinho at Barcelona. I think the big question is whether that's in 2018 or 2017. I'm not convinced that this back injury is particularly severe, should we put it that way. But I think part of the problem is for Liverpool is that they were very confident throughout that they would keep Coutinho. I don't think they expected bids of that size to come in. I don't think they expected Coutinho to push for the move, and I don't think they've really got very much by way of a contingency plan in terms of sometimes when you know a player is going, you line up a deal to bring in someone else. I don't think Liverpool have done that at all. So I think they may very much have to dig their heels in, just because if Coutinho goes, they can't replace him. It's then a question of how you placate him for the following season, which I don't think is necessarily going to be that hard if there is an agreement in place that he can go. But it's not the situation they need at this time. I still think they should beat Hoffenheim with or without Coutinho, but he is a special player. He is a player who can score a goal out of absolutely nothing. And he is someone that Klopp would definitely want in the team against them.
Brilliant, Richard. Well, thanks very much for your thoughts this week.
Not at all. Anytime.
Right, chaps, let's go all the way back to the start of the weekend, Friday night, Arsenal-Leicester City.
It seems so long ago.
It doesn't it, Jas? Yeah. It almost seemed like Arsenal were about to do an Arsenal, but then managed to kind of pull things around. A couple of inspired substitutions from Arsene Wenger in Aaron Ramsey and Olivier Giroud got the 3 points. Emirates are buzzing for now.
But that wasn't the case during the game, was it? You could see how the air turned acidic before the equaliser at half-time. Yeah, it's a frightening how quickly Arsenal turned, because don't forget they were ahead after 90 seconds. 2-1 down after, midway through the first half. And you could, although we weren't physically there, you could just tell it pulsating through the TV screen, the Emirates was turning toxic.
It's going to be a problem all season, isn't it?
Well, it didn't feel as if last season had finished the way, the whole atmosphere around the game. You were almost waiting for, it was almost on a knife edge again for the first match of the season. You don't think it should be at that level. But I think there are a couple of worrying things and a couple of things that they might be optimistic about. Is one of the worrying things is that they finished the match with, was it two fullbacks in their back three?
Three fullbacks.
Yeah. They started with two.
And a midfielder.
Yeah, exactly. And Holding, I know Holding's very young, but he looked visibly nervous about the whole thing. Like he gave the ball away quite a lot.
He looked like he had a mistake in him every time on the ball, didn't he?
Yeah, and it doesn't help if you've got, was it Monreal he had beside him, or someone who's not comfortable in that position either? It's not a Koscielny or a Mertesacker or whoever else they've got in there.
Callum Chambers.
Mustafi was who I was looking for. Thank you. They've got to be concerned about that. But if you want to flip it around the other side, that they've come through that and they've managed to get a morale boosting victory. Even though they were made to work for it, they still scored two goals late. They showed in Giroud that they do have someone who can come off the bench and get goals and change it up, which Arsenal didn't have that last season before they had Lacazette there. And Lacazette actually looked a bit better once he moved out onto the flank. So there's reason for a bit of optimism there. It's just, as you said, it's the overriding sense is this is just the exact same as last year, and there's still huge questions about their defence.
And again, something else we touched on, a concern of ours with Arsenal last week was going forward with a midfield of, I think we mentioned Granit Xhaka and Aaron Ramsey. Now, he started with Granit Xhaka and Mohamed Elneny. And was it Vardy's goal? Now, everyone was laying the boot into Xhaka for giving the ball away. But it was actually Elneny who played him into trouble in the first place, giving him a, what we know as a hospital pass, leaving Xhaka with no choice but to kick it wide. So, yeah, that I agree with you. There's plenty of optimism there. It was, you know, very good to see Danny Welbeck back fit and scoring goals again. Took his goal. Well, he tried his hardest to miss, didn't he? But he did put it away. But, yeah, you know, when they were caught out of possession for Vardy's goal, the transition and the width that the defence found themselves apart for him to just steal in is a real concern. They obviously haven't learned how to, you know, close the ball down or cut out the important attacking spaces. And, yeah, some of their players, they've got to step up. Elneny, I think, really is not the requisite level for a team like Arsenal, with a team like Arsenal's aspirations. But, you know, I certainly don't want to lay the boot into them. It was a terrific game. What a game to kick off, you know, seven goals on the opening day. And it set the tone, other than Southampton and Swansea, but it set the tone for the rest of the week. So, you know, and Arsene Wenger, I think, does deserve more than a half of football before the fans absolutely go gunning for him again.
Yeah. Do you think that'll change if Sanchez is to go? Because, you know, this is rumbling on. We're not too sure if he's definitely going to be there for at the end of the transfer window, or whether or not Arsenal are going to be kind of scratching around looking for a world-class player to replace him at the last minute.
But that's the thing. If you sell him, you've got no time to get a replacement in for him. It would be, you know, sorry to sound overdramatic, it would be the death knell in their season after only one game, because, you know, whatever they hope to achieve this season, it's going to be largely off the back of Alexis Sanchez, mm-hmm. who, when he's fit, obviously he's out for this game and the Stoke game. But, yeah, I mean, whatever they hope to do, Arsenal and Arsene Wenger, Sanchez is at the forefront of it.
Right, gents, we've kind of covered all the big teams, all the big talking points from their games this weekend. Let's have a look at the highlights and a few of the big talking points from the rest of the league. I think we should really start at Selhurst Park, shouldn't we? That's what an introduction to the Premier League for Huddersfield and David Wagner, and for Frank de Boer. Which was on the opposite end of things. Cracking result for Huddersfield. But obviously an awful lot of work for Frank de Boer to be doing at Crystal Palace.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he came in amid much fanfare for a... You know, he was going to take Palace in this whole new direction away from Allardyce. Sam Allardyce is, well-drilled, well-organised teams. And there was nothing like that on show during that game. Huddersfield Town, watch the highlights of it, just absolutely tore them apart. They were more worthy 3-0 winners. They could quite easily have blown Palace out of the water. Massive work for Frank de Boer to do. Like you say, what an introduction. He very quickly needs to get to grips and realise that this is not the Dutch Eredivisie, this is not Ajax. The players at his disposal, you could see him gesticulating from the sidelines, actually, you know, telling his players to lump the ball forward to stop Huddersfield's high press. Now, he's abandoned his principles, you know, so quickly in that game. But when you're 3-0 down, what else could you do? But yeah, it certainly was a rude awakening for the Dutchman, and I'm sure he'll set his team up, you know, maybe even taking a leaf out of Sam Allardyce's book to just be much more organised defensively.
That's the thing with Palace. They've kind of lost their identity, I think, over the last maybe season and a half or however long back it stretches, that you just thought they were establishing themselves as a mid-table Premier League team, and obviously the idea would be to build from there, but... It's, you know, they're going to be more open now. They're going to be more expansive, try and play attacking football. And I don't know at the moment if they've got the right resources there to play that style of football. So it's an interesting one. You know, things can unravel very, very quickly in this league, and De Boer's find that out, and he will find that out if this continues over the next couple of weeks.
Full credit to Huddersfield, though. Yeah,
absolutely, mate. Yeah. And you know, we're going to be touching on, you know, fantastic debuts. I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong. Steve Mooney scoring his first goal for a team like Huddersfield Town, and they were top of the table for, you know, 24 hours. So yeah, fantastic introduction to the Premier League for them.
Of course, the other big story from Saturday, who claimed a lot of the back pages, Rooney's return to Everton. That went pretty well, didn't it?
It did indeed. The winner on your your return, your first start for the club in 13 years, I think it was. So, to be honest, that was something that I didn't expect. I thought Rooney, having seen what he had done last season with United, I think he'd scored 9 goals in his last 50 games or Premier League games for United. So I thought all the problems he had at United were going to transfer to Everton in terms of, where do you fit him in? Is he compatible with the other players that you have around him? But from what I'd seen, I'd only seen the goal, to be fair, but from what Koeman was saying and what a couple of other players said afterwards, is that just his kind of game mentality and, you know, his experience and his know-how. I think Sean through there were saying that it wasn't just the goal, which was brilliantly taken. It was a superb ball from, I'm not too sure who.
Was it Calvin Lewitt? I'm saying that name wrong, I'm sure. But yeah, no, I agree totally. The header was so well taken. Yeah, that kind of burst into the box.
The run. Yeah.
You could sense the moment that cross come in that Rooney was going to tuck that one away. But again, reading on Koeman's comments, his game management, like you say, is not just necessarily his passing. Reading Richard Jolly's report, he defensively, his headers from corners and set pieces, it was Alan Shearer-esque. And another thing that Koeman touched on was, when your team needs a breather, when you just need someone to, ride a challenge or get someone to barge into you so you can go down, just give your defence a little bit of a breather. He was saying Rooney has that. Rooney knows when to do that, whereas his other midfielders like Gay and Davies, they don't. And I think that's what impressed Koeman as much as anything, as much as the goal and as much as the performance.
And maybe it's the lease of life that Rooney needs, I think, because his career was stalling. He's only 31, remember, an old 31. But maybe this is kind of the injection of something a bit different, the freshness that'll see him kind of get back to a decent enough level.
Right, lads, let's finish off just on one quick trivia point. From the West Brom Bournemouth game, perhaps the most unglamorous fixture of the weekend, 1-0 win, debut goal for Hegazi. He's the 5th Egyptian to score on his Premier League debut. Can you name the others?
Can we Google?
Yeah, put your laptop down.
Mido.
Yes.
Mido.
Mohamed Salah from the weekend.
Yes.
See, that's a controversial one, isn't it? Because he's already played for Chelsea, but I guess he's Liverpool debut. But.
Yeah.
Who's the guy at Wigan?
Zaki.
And
I'm trying to think who else.
I would guess. Is it another Tottenham boy? Is it Hossam Ghali?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, very good. Well done. Clean sweep. Well done, chaps.
Well done, Steve.
Cheers. Well, yeah, you were no help.
Well, chaps, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much for stopping by, as always.
Cheers, guys. Appreciate it.
Mate. Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. I'm John Turner with John McCauley, Steve Luckings and Richard Jolly. Subscribe to Extra Time on iTunes and find us on the website at thenational.ae. Thanks for listening.